My Fourth Significant Relationship, Part 1. In October 2002, Zelda and I finally broke up for good. I knew I needed to start dating again to prevent me being lured back to Zelda for the umpteenth time. On one of the previous occasions, when we had broken up, I had tried using an internet dating service to meet new women. It was fun, interesting, amusing, and scary. But it was a fantastic and easy way to meet people. I met all sorts of women from all sorts of life and differing professions, such as lawyers, psychologists, secretaries, and businesswomen. To me, it highlighted how many single people are out there, and generally, the only way single people tend to meet is through work or being introduced by mutual friends. This was a whole new ball game, but it was fun for a while. So in late October 2002, with renewed vigor, I decided to try this medium again. I met a number of nice women and dated some of them more than once. In fact, I was having such fun I was meeting some of them for lunch and others for dinner. It was the most hectic social dating life that I'd ever experienced, and I was enjoying it, for a while at least. For some reason, I decided to contact a much younger woman. At the time, I was 41 and she was only 26. Most of the other women I'd been dating were no more than 8 years younger than me, so why I contacted her, I have no idea. But we started chatting and eventually decided to meet sometime late in November 2002. I found Debbie to be attractive, with a nice figure, but she was quiet and reserved, basically very shy. She was wearing a sleeveless top, which revealed a tattoo around her upper arm. I asked her about this, and she said she had two others, one on her shoulder and one on her hip. I'd never been fond of tattoos. I suppose I'd always been somewhat judgmental about them, but it didn't really bother me as much as I thought it might. We had dinner, where I ended up doing most of the talking, which is unusual for me, but it was a pleasant evening. She had two very young sons, aged 4 years old and 7 months, from different fathers, neither of whom she had married. The young baby was totally unplanned, and she only found out that she was pregnant after the relationship had ended. The father wanted her to have an abortion, but Debbie decided she was going to have the child with or without his support. One of the statements I made to Debbie that evening, and to all the other women I had dated, was that I really did not believe I would ever get married again, and I definitely would not have any more children. I wanted to make sure that the person I was dating was under no illusions about my position on these matters. I knew they were potentially important issues for the women. The last thing I wanted was to develop a relationship with someone who had their heart set on having children, for example. Rather walk away from it at the outset than have to deal with a situation at a later date, when there are serious emotions involved. I had learned this lesson the hard way. Anyway, as she seemed like a good, kind person, I said I would call her so we could decide whether we wanted to see each other again. I called her and she said she'd like to see me again. I suppose the fact that she was attractive, good company, and 15 years younger than me was a bit of an ego thing, but what the heck, why not? The next date was arranged for a few days later, and I had booked a table at a popular live music venue called the Blues Room. That afternoon, when I called to confirm the arrangement, she said that she had to tell me something extremely important. I'll never forget the conversation. I was in my car, having just parked outside the gym I attended. I suggested we talk about it when we met, but she said she felt she had to tell me before we met, as I might change my mind about seeing her. I was somewhat surprised and curious. She explained that as a result of the birth of her second child, she was experiencing financial difficulties as she had received no financial assistance from the father of the child, and her current salary was not that great. She said she was thinking of going back part-time to Teasers, a well-known and popular upmarket strip club. I asked her what she meant by going back. She said that a few years before she'd been unable to obtain work, so she worked at Teasers for about a year. During that time, she saved enough money to pay for an IT college course, where she learned to design and develop websites, which was the work she was currently doing. I was shocked. There was no way I could picture this shy, reserved girl stripping. I could understand that she had the right body for it, but the personality? Now, if I had been judgmental about tattoos, then I was very opinionated about strippers. I had never been to Teasers or any other strip club before, as I had no desire to watch naked women prancing about me or dancing on my lap. To me it was like window shopping, an exercise I'd always found somewhat futile. Why look if you can't buy? And sex was something that I would never pay for. So watching a stripper was not a consideration for me. Yes, I can imagine the number of men out there saying that by whining and dining a woman you are paying for sex indirectly, but I disagree. She doesn't have to sleep with you at the end of the date, but how many prostitutes will say no if you pay her price? I must have become very quiet trying to digest this new and confusing information, as she had to check to see if I was still on the line. I had choices to make. I could walk away right now, I could date her anyway, or I could help her financially and stop her from going back to that life. I made a gut-feel call that went against my analytical head and asked her how much money she needed to settle her outstanding debts. She refused to tell me at first, as she felt uncomfortable with my question and had not expected it. After some persuasion, she told me that it was 4,000 rand. I said I would give her the money, providing she made a commitment to herself not to go back to Teasers, ever. She was reluctant to accept the money, but eventually agreed on condition that the money was given to her as a loan and that she would one day pay it back. I agreed. I then said we could go on the date as planned, and we did. When we met, it was a little uncomfortable for me at first, as I kept trying to reconcile how this soft-spoken, quiet young woman could perform as a stripper. I was trying to deal with my preconceived ideas about what type of person I had assumed a stripper was, and she was everything but that. What I didn't realize was that this was the start of my journey to become a truly non-judgmental person. Soon we relaxed and we had a great evening. I had already written a check for 4,500, which was a little more than she needed, and I handed it to her before the evening was over. I could see she was embarrassed and relieved at the same time. At the end of the evening, I walked her to her car and we briefly kissed each other good night. I told her I would call her the next day. I had lots of mixed thoughts running through my mind that night. On the one hand, I really liked her, not just because she was attractive and had a great figure, but because she was down to earth and genuine, and my gut feel told me she was a good person. On the other hand, she had once been a stripper, and I was not partial to tattoos. These concerns were really based on my prejudices and the thought of being potentially embarrassed if someone recognized her. I decided to trust my gut and called her the next day, and we arranged to meet for lunch with her best friend. It was then that it became clear we would have a relationship, but I knew I would have a challenge dealing with my preconceptions and prejudices. She was living with her mother in Benoni, which was quite a distance and definitely not convenient for either of us. Debbie's father had been murdered in Zimbabwe shortly after she was born. Even though her mom got married a few years later and had a son with her husband, whom she had since divorced, Debbie never really had a father figure in her life. There were upsides to her living with her mother, as her mom was able to look after the kids, which allowed Debbie to come through and stay over once or twice during the week. On the weekends, she would pack up the kids and spend the weekend at my house. This opened up a whole new world for me, and one that I had definitely not planned or envisaged. I now had a young baby in the house, something I hadn't had to deal with for many years. If this was a new challenge for me, then it was a whole new world for Brett, who was 18 at the time. When Shayna came to live with me in August 2003, she also had to learn to deal with this new environment. Although Callum, the baby, was relatively good, his four-year-old brother Trevor was a handful. This was understandable because he had never had a father figure in his life and neither his mom nor his granny had the ability or desire to discipline him. He was extremely naughty, and I told Debbie that if something wasn't done about it, he would become ostracized at school and left off all the birthday invitation lists. She didn't think he was that bad, really, but sadly it wasn't long hereafter that she actually found out he hadn't been invited to several parties. To me, it was fairly obvious that all he was craving was attention, read, discipline. As I'd noticed that she did not have a close bond with him. In fact, Granny was much closer to him. When I asked her about this, she admitted as much, the reason being that she had worked at Teasers for a year after he was born. In desperation, she'd had to resort to Teasers, but the working hours were long, from midday to 2 or 3 o'clock the following morning. This left her with absolutely no time for Trevor, and so he was brought up by Granny. What compounded Trevor's frustration was the attention that Callum got from Debbie. A new baby in the house always grabs the attention, but Debbie had a strong bond with Callum, perhaps because he was the child she was not supposed to have had. She'd been desperate to have a daughter, so maybe that was one of the reasons to have the baby. The fact that he was a boy was not a factor, but to Trevor, the love and attention that Callum got was. What was also apparent to me was the lack of open displays of love and affection in their family. I had been brought up in an environment where we always kissed our parents hello and goodbye or goodnight. My parents were always holding hands, they called each other little pet names, when they were not fighting, that is. I practiced this open display of affection in all my personal relationships, with my partners and with my kids. In fact, even Brett had to kiss me goodbye up until he was almost 18, even though I knew this embarrassed him, getting dropped off at school and having to run over in the car and kiss his father goodbye. Deep down, children sense that such simple displays of love and affection make them loved and cared for. I never saw Debbie kiss her mom, or vice versa for that matter. In fact, Debbie said that she and her brother had not been brought up that way, and thus she knew no differently. I immediately put a stop to that excuse and insisted we always kiss each other hello and goodbye, and that she make the effort to do the same with her boys. It took a while for her to get into the habit with me, but she never really managed to do it, consistently, that is, with her boys. In fact, if the truth be told, she only ever kissed the boys if I encouraged or insisted that she did. From the time I had started dating women I met on the internet, Zelda had not stopped contacting me. It was so bad that it was almost harassment. What with the constant SMSs to my mobile phone and calls to the home phone, she had decided that she wasn't going to give up on our relationship, but in my mind and in my heart, I knew it was over. Zelda also tried the same internet dating site where she had met a guy by the name of Marcus, who, funnily enough, had also met Debbie through the site. Debbie told me about him when we had discussed our mutual experiences of the dating site. Debbie had started on it a month or two before me, and obviously had met a few men. On another occasion, out of the blue, she made a comment to me which was totally unsolicited and therefore seemed strange at the time. She said she had never slept with any of the men she had met through the site. My response was that it wasn't necessary to tell me this, as what she had done in her past was done and should stay there. Just the same applied to me. One evening, the gate bell rang, and when I looked outside, I saw that it was Zelda. She had been calling, but I never answered her calls. I simply ignored them. I did not open the gate, but walked outside to see what she wanted. She was very upset and quite beside herself, and proceeded to shout at me, telling how she had met Marcus, and that he told her that he had dated Debbie. Marcus mentioned that Debbie had stopped seeing him because she'd met a guy by the name of Ken, who lived in Bryanston. Zelda had then realized that the Ken was me, so she'd pried Marcus for more information, who told her that Debbie was a former stripper and was very good in bed. Why he would want to share this was strange, but here she was outside my gate telling me that I'd made a huge mistake and I shouldn't be seeing Debbie. She wanted to know how someone like me, who'd never been to a strip club, could even consider doing this. I told Zelda I was aware of all this, but had made my decision and that she should move on with her own life. Clearly, I didn't know all this, as Debbie had lied to me about sleeping with Marcus. The issue wasn't about the fact that she had. She had every right to do so, as it happened before we met. The issue was that she had lied to me on a totally unsolicited basis. She had volunteered the lie for some strange reason. I was hurt, angry, and confused. We had agreed that the foundation of our relationship would be based on trust and truth. We would never lie to each other, and now this agreement had already been broken. I remember standing on my bedroom balcony when I called Debbie to ask her why she had lied to me. She didn't have an answer, but she was so upset that her mother ended up speaking to me. I stated that I was seriously concerned about the fact that she'd lied to me for no apparent reason, and that the basis of trust had been broken. Her mother urged me to give her a chance, that she knew that Debbie really liked me and wanted to be with me. I seriously considered walking away before we got more involved, but I didn't. Exactly why, I cannot tell you. Lessons learned. 74. Never cast judgment. At times God has a wonderful sense of humor, and so for all my judgmental views on tattoos and strippers, I ended up falling in love with a former stripper with tattoos. 75. There is no such thing as a white lie. A lie is a lie is a lie. 76. Never tell lies, as they will always come back to haunt you. Rather face the consequences of telling the truth than face the consequences of having told a lie. Although we had only met in November 2002, we went on holiday to Cape Town over the Christmas period that year. Debbie had booked the air tickets for herself and her boys some months before, and they were planning on staying with her family down there. We decided that I should go as well, but I organized accommodation for all of us. Given the late notice, it was extremely difficult to arrange decent accommodation, but we managed to find something reasonable. This was the first time that her boys were flying, and I was not looking forward to the flight, as babies generally battle with their ears, especially during the takeoff and the descent. The flight was a challenge, as Debbie stresses very easily, but all in all, it wasn't too bad. This holiday was a big test for both of us, but for different reasons. In her case, it was the first time that she would be spending an extended period of time looking after both her boys without any help from Granny and the domestic worker that took care of Callum during the day when she was at work. For me, it was a test to see whether I could spend an extended period of time with this very young family. Despite a few hiccups here and there, we both seemed to cope reasonably well. There was, however, one particular incident with Trevor which made me lose my sense of humour. One afternoon, it was time for the kids to have their afternoon nap, so once they were down, we decided to do the same. A little later, when I got up, I went out of the room to find Trevor in the lounge, and I spotted my sunglasses lying fairly mangled on the floor. These were not ordinary sunglasses. They were prescription glasses for my nearsightedness. I cannot drive without glasses due to my reduced vision and my eyes that are extremely sensitive to sunlight. When I asked him what had happened, he gave me the obvious answer. I don't know, I just saw them like that. It was obvious he was lying. With a great amount of determination, I sat down and tried to explain to him that he had done two things wrong. Firstly, the evil act of destruction, and secondly, that he lied about it. I warned him that if he ever did either of these two acts again, then he would be punished, which meant a spanking and spending time alone in his room, plus no treats for a given period of time. Judging by his look, he was not convinced. He'd faced empty threats before. I spoke to Debbie about this and said that I must have her permission to deal with her boys in an appropriate manner, which included spanking, but in a non-violent manner and never in anger. To me, this was a non-negotiable, as I cannot and have never tolerated badly behaved kids. Given that she and her mother chose not to discipline the boys, someone had to do it for their own benefit. Debbie readily accepted, as she knew it had to be done, and it was easier for her to have someone else do it. I suppose having brought four kids into this world, I was bound to know a bit, and in reality, that is all we need to know as parents. All kids want is love, discipline, and consistency. It is that simple, but we choose to complicate it. If we as parents are consistent with sharing our love and discipline, then, based on my own proven personal experience, I have found that kids will respond to that environment. If we agree the boundaries and the consequences for abusing those boundaries, and we consistently mete out the disciplinary measures as agreed, then kids will learn that it is a non-negotiable. However, as parents, our single biggest failing is not to follow through on a consistent basis. This inconsistency creates confusion for the kids, so they will test the boundaries, hoping that they might get away with it. An interesting anecdote relating to this issue was an experience I shared with Brett when he was in grade 11, that's standard 9, when he was 17. One Thursday morning, I received a call at work inquiring why Brett wasn't at school. This surprised me as I dropped him off at school that morning. Apparently, he had not attended the science class, so I called him on his mobile phone and asked him where he was. He replied, "I'm at school. Why? Where am I supposed to be?" This was a typical wise-ass comment that he had built up in his amazing repertoire. I told him that I had been informed that he had not attended the science class. He explained that as they were due to break up for the midterm holiday the following day, the teacher had told them that they need not attend class, so nobody had, and were now all sitting on the field. As it turned out, only a few students attended the class, and the teacher chose to call the parents of only 5 of the students that had bunked. Unfortunately, Brett was one of the 5. And so I told him he was in trouble, and that I would deal with him when I fetched him later in the day. When I fetched him from school, he quickly repeated the story, but my response was simple. As far as the teacher was concerned, he had bunked class, and I got the call. I was paying for him to attend classes at one of the top private schools in the country, so I took exception to it, and his punishment was grounding him for the weekend. He was aghast. He could not understand why he was being punished and not his friends. The real issue for him, however, was that on the Friday night the school was having one of their most important social events, and as Brett was new to the class, he felt it essential for him to be there. "Dad, I can't afford not to be seen there." I understood his predicament, but I believed it was necessary for me to put my foot down. He had breached the boundary. I stood firm, but that did not stop him from trying to plea bargain on many different fronts, such as, "Dad, if you let me go on Friday, then you can ground me for the next few weekends as well." Or, "Dad, please beat me black and blue, but just let me go for an hour to be seen." But the cleverest was, "Dad, you must look me in the eyes and tell me that you never bunked a class at school." To which I replied, "Yes, boy, I have bunked classes, but I never got caught. And if I had been caught, I would have suffered the consequences just like you." That blew the wind out of his sails, and all he could then ask was, "What am I going to do tonight when everyone is at the social?" "Sit with me at the bar and we can spend time bonding," I replied. The following year, I received a call from Brett at school to inform me that it was a breakup day. They were due to have a late chapel service, but he and some friends were thinking of leaving school earlier. I politely inquired why he was telling me this unimportant information, but I knew exactly what it was about. He was trying to get my approval for a decision he wanted to make, but he knew there were consequences if he got caught. So I did what most experienced fathers do. I played dumb. To be fair, I did help him just a little. I reminded him that he now had his own car, which he drove to school every day, and parked in an open lot. If someone noticed his car was not there and he wasn't at the chapel service, then there was the possibility they might just figure out that he wasn't there. Having said that, I reminded him that it was his decision, and for every decision there are consequences. To this day, I don't know whether he attended the service or bunked, and I've never even asked him. It was his decision and his alone. He had learned the lesson of choices and consequences, which was what was important to me. As a parent, it is critical to be consistent. If you are able to do this, then you will reap the rewards. But more importantly, you will establish an understanding with your children that will serve them for the rest of their time. In January 2003, Stephen was due to spend a week of his school holidays with me. I had made the arrangements with Annie a long time before and had bought and paid for the air ticket. On the morning, just before his flight was due to leave, I phoned her to see if he was checked onto his flight. She asked me whether I had received a letter from her lawyer, which at that stage I had not. She had decided not to send him, as she deemed it not to be in his best interests, and got her lawyer to write me a letter to this effect. No reason was given in the letter. It was just stated that it was not in his interests. I was angry. This wasn't the first time she had pulled this trick. What I subsequently found out was that Zelda had phoned Annie to tell her that I was dating a former stripper. So Annie decided to do what she loved doing, to hurt me using my children as leverage. Lessons learned. 77. Never use your children as leverage to get back at your former spouse, as they suffer more pain than you or your former spouse. Back to Debbie's kids. I chose to take an active role in their lives, and Trevor soon warmed to it. He learned that I was more than willing to give him more attention and love, but if he misbehaved in a really naughty way, he was punished. The punishment might mean that he spent time in his room on his own, or if he was really naughty, he got the occasional spanking. By spanking, this involved a 2-minute lecture on why he was being spanked and emphasizing the fact that his mother and I loved him, which was the reason why he was being disciplined. After the spanking, which was never more than 2 hand smacks on the buttocks, I always asked him why he'd been punished, and he always managed to remember the reason. Afterwards, I would always hug him and explain that he was loved and that I hated having to punish him, but that I really wished he never did anything so naughty that needed this again. No doubt, there are many people who cannot accept this approach to discipline. They will argue that it is not acceptable. My counter to do this is the continuous, desperate degeneration of our children's behavior, which has generally resulted in the total lack of respect that the youth of today display towards their parents, their teachers, and their peers. It's sad that the children of today are generally allowed to be a law unto themselves, but we as parents have only ourselves to blame. We created the society that we live in just as our kids will create theirs. What we choose to take into our society is our choice, the morals, the values, the principles. But equally, we cannot abandon these important choices and let our kids choose their own. At first, Trevor struggled to accept that there were consequences to his behavior, but he soon realized where the boundaries were. He understood that if he did not listen or heed the warnings, he would be punished. Equally, he always sought me out for love and affection. He always wanted to sit on my lap or be in my space. I put this down to 2 reasons. Firstly, I never shunned him or pushed him away, even when the last thing I wanted was for him to be all over me. Secondly, he needed a male figure in his life. His father was working in Nigeria. It was wonderful to see him transform from a naughty, irritating brat to a normal boy. I was fairly strict and firm with both boys, but consistent. At times, I was accused by Debbie of being stricter on her boys than my own children. Possibly this was true, but I had felt that they needed this because they had never had any discipline. The only time Debbie enforced discipline was when she was angry, but her screaming and shouting at her kids never worked. In fact, it just upset the boys and made them feel more unloved and rejected. A factor that troubled me at the time was the guilt I felt in bringing up someone else's young kids when I wasn't there for my own boys, Stephen and Jamie. Compared to Trevor, Stephen is only 4 years older and Jamie a year younger. Perhaps that affected me. I'm not really sure. Over the period that I was part of their lives, I made sure that both Trevor and Callum got love and attention from me. Many times I had both of them sitting on my lap. I ensured that they got tougher, which meant tickling them, roughing them up, and wrestling with them. They got more attention from me than from Debbie, as she struggled to show affection. She did try, but it was not natural instinctive behavior for her. However, with me it was different, and she was quite demonstrative in her displays of affection. Although I had settled down and become used to dealing with two little boys, I felt constrained by the new environment. In my previous relationship with Zelda, I was used to doing whatever we wanted to, whenever we wanted to. With no children around, if we suddenly decided to go out at night, we could. If we wanted to go away for the weekend, we did. I can be spontaneous, and sometimes I like doing things at the drop of a hat. This wasn't possible with two young kids, especially over the weekends. Although Debbie's mom, Pat, was prepared to look after the boys once or twice during the week, she couldn't do so over the weekends. She had her own boyfriend, Ian, who was quite a bit older than Pat, and not too partial to Debbie's kids, as he found Trevor to be too naughty. In fact, they were basically barred from Ian's house. Another factor that complicated things was that most of my friends were my age or older and did not have small kids, so socializing with them was not ideal. Trying to manage Trevor and later Callum in someone else's child-unfriendly house was too stressful, so I chose not to do it. These were my choices, so not for a second am I trying to blame anyone. I'm merely highlighting the fact that life was very different for me at that time. Lessons learned? 78. There are a few critical factors required to raise children. A. Give them lots of love and attention. B. Give them your trust and teach them about accountability. C. Give them boundaries and consequences for exceeding those boundaries. D. The consequences must result in some form of discipline or punishment, which does not necessarily have to be physical. It could be the withdrawal of certain privileges, that is, giving them an earlier curfew or grounding them. But it must be a privilege that they value, otherwise they will not feel the pain. E. Apply whatever discipline you have decided on in a consistent manner. Never set a precedent where you allow them to get off with a warning, as the next time they will ask you to justify this. F. Never apply punishment or discipline in anger. Cool off before you do this and explain to them why they are being punished and remind them of your love for them. Unfortunately, in April 2003, Ian was murdered in his garage when he and Pat returned from an evening out. Some armed robbers were waiting for him as they believed he had a lot of cash in his safe. They shot Ian in front of Pat before fleeing the scene. She watched him die in her arms before the paramedics could arrive. This was a difficult period for the family, and although Debbie and Ian had had their differences, she had formed a close relationship with him. In a way, he was the father she had never had. Pat obviously battled to come to terms with his death, and after a couple of months, she decided she needed a change of environment. Another factor that may have influenced her was that Debbie and her boys were spending weekends with me. She decided to move from Benoni to the northern suburbs of Johannesburg and started looking for a house. Eventually, she decided to buy a property in a new development only a few kilometres from my house. I thought that this was a great idea, as it meant less travelling for Debbie and, to a lesser degree, me. Also, if suddenly we decided to go over for a weekend or to go out, we could drop the kids off with her. I really liked the idea, as it would make things easier for everyone. During this time, Debbie and I were trying to build our relationship, but there were many factors that made it difficult. I was much older, wiser, more experienced, more established, and very set in my ways. I was used to being in control and getting things done my way. She was battling with her website development job, where she was getting paid a pittance and usually late. She was struggling financially, so I helped her out on a few occasions by paying off her debts, but always against her wishes. She was definitely not a spendthrift. It was a simple case of her costs exceeding her income. Only when Callum was about a year old did his father begin paying maintenance, negligible amounts as they were. Her kids were continually sick, especially Callum. By the time he was 18 months old, he'd already had a hernia operation and had his tonsils and half his adenoids removed. Every third week, Callum was at the doctor, being put on antibiotics or some other form of medication. Some of these expenses were not covered by medical aid, and so she needed to pay them herself. It was a constant battle for her, and because she's such a stubborn person, she always tried to deal with these issues herself, which caused her much stress. She then decided to try and work for herself to make more money. But as capable and talented as she was in designing and developing websites, she battled to find clients, so her earnings were sporadic. I managed to help a little by getting her some work. I contracted her to develop my company's website, as well as some other colleagues and suppliers I knew. After a few months, she decided to get a full-time job and finally found something suitable. Firstly, a job in Sandton, and then later, out on the East Rand near Benoni. Often, the collective stress of her kids, her finances, her work, the travelling to and from my house became too much, and she would blow up. It could be the tiniest, least significant thing that would cause it, but she would lose her temper and scream and shout. Her way of dealing with a conflict was either fight or flight. Inevitably, once she had fought, she would flee. For a petite lady, she could behave extremely violently and aggressively. She weighed no more than 48 kilograms, but as the old cliche goes, dynamite comes in small packages. She would throw things, slam doors, kick, punch, and bite, whatever it took to release that pressure that had been building up inside her. Then she would flee, which normally meant packing her stuff and getting in her car and leaving. Sometimes it was worse, like if we were in the car, she would want to open the passenger door and jump out, even if a car was travelling at 120 kph. She had to escape, whatever it took. I found these moments pretty scary, and although I had witnessed similar behaviour from Zelda, Debbie's was infinitely worse. Sometimes I handled it okay, other times not so well at all. I suppose my disdain for this type of behaviour makes things worse, not better. For example, I would respond by saying, "Well, if you want to leave, you know where the door is." With hindsight, I can see now this type of response was like fueling the fire. If we were out in a public place like a restaurant or a nightclub and had an argument, she would just walk off and leave, sometimes without her handbag. She didn't give a thought to her personal safety, yet somehow she would always manage to find her way home, either by phoning a friend or hitchhiking or taking a taxi. I couldn't begin to understand her behaviour, as it made no sense to me. She would break up and make up before the cycle repeated itself once more. Despite all this, I loved her and wanted to help her. I tried, but it was always a case of one step forward, two steps back. In March 2003, my father began suffering severe pain in his side, and despite many visits to different doctors, none of them managed to diagnose the problem. Eventually, after a couple of months and many different medications which had not worked, he was sent for more scans and clinical tests. They finally identified a tumour on his lung, which they believed was cancerous, and decided that it should be removed. We were all devastated by the news, as we had not been expecting it. At this time, Debbie and I were in the middle of one of our regular breakup periods. On hearing the news, I felt, well, lost and lonely. My parents had always liked Zelda, and I really felt like talking to her. I guess I just wanted to talk to someone who knew me well. I'm not a person to share my emotions and feelings easily. I'm a complex but simple person. I had been through a similar situation with Zelda when her father was very ill, so I knew she would understand how I was feeling. I sent her an SMS to let her know about my father, and as it turned out, she was in Zurich on business, but was due back in the next few days. We spoke on the phone briefly, and I was glad to re-establish contact with her. Early in July 2003, my father had a lung operation, during which they removed the top third of his lung. He recovered exceptionally quickly and was discharged a few days earlier than expected. A few weeks earlier, I had booked to go with a few other friends to the Tri-Nations rugby test between Australia and South Africa to be played at Newlands in Cape Town. I'd paid for the airfares, accommodation and tickets weeks beforehand. My father's operation was not perfect timing for my little jaunt, but based on his quick recovery, he was insistent that I went. He was discharged on the Monday, and the test match was on the following Saturday. We were due to fly out on the Friday afternoon, but the closer we got to the time, the more uneasy I began to feel. I understood one of the reasons for my uneasiness. The group of guys I was going with were the husbands or partners of Debbie's friends, and Debbie and I weren't seeing each other anymore. I wasn't particularly partial to most of the guys, except one of them. But this wasn't the real reason. I don't know why, but I had a concern for my father. There was no reason for this, as he was in good spirits and doing well, but I had this uneasy feeling in my gut that I should not go. Finally, on the Friday at about lunchtime, I was in a bookstore when I began to pray to God to ask him for a clear sign about whether I should stay. I can't remember what exactly I asked him to give me as a sign, but it was something so specific that I would know it immediately. I received the sign and decided not to go. I phoned my friends and told them I was not going. That evening I spoke to Zelda and told her about my father's rapid recovery, but that I was concerned about him and had decided at the last minute not to go on my trip. We had seen each other once or twice since she had returned from Zurich, but on a casual basis. She invited me to come and watch the game at her house the next day, which I accepted. On Saturday morning, I phoned my father to see how he was feeling. He was well. He asked me what the weather was like in Cape Town, so I told him I hadn't gone as there was an urgent business issue that I'd needed to attend to. He then invited me to come and watch the game with him. I told him I'd already made other plans but would visit him on Sunday. That afternoon I watched the match at Zelda's house. It was a great match which South Africa won. I was surprised that I hadn't received any telephone calls and SMS messages about the game, which was normally the case. I went looking for my phone and eventually found it in my car. There were 12 missed calls. As I identified them, I got a fright. They were from my parents' home number, my sister's mobile phone, and my brother-in-law's mobile phone. I called my sister and she told me that my father had collapsed and that they were busy putting him into an ambulance. I asked where they were taking him, and she said back to the hospital in Krugersdorp, where he'd had the surgery. I jumped into my car and drove as fast as I could to get there. I arrived not long after the ambulance and met my mother and sister. Apparently, while watching the rugby, my father began to complain that his chest was sore. At some stage, he got up to go to the kitchen to get something to drink and collapsed on the kitchen floor. My mother heard him fall, went to see what had happened, and found him unconscious. It looked like he had suffered a heart attack. She called the paramedics and my sister, who lived nearby. My father was admitted to intensive care as the medical staff tried to ascertain what had happened. After a while, they still weren't sure, but my father was now heavily sedated and completely unaware of his surroundings. They eventually found that my father's lung had collapsed from excessive fluid buildup. They drained it. We left the hospital very late that night, and I decided to stay over at my parents' home with my mother. The next morning, we went back to the hospital. He was still heavily sedated, but stable. At about lunchtime, the doctor suggested that we leave and told us that the worst was over and that he should be fine. I went home that night, but just after 5 o'clock the following morning, I received a call from my mother to tell me that we need to get to the hospital quickly. I rushed over and the doctor said that my father had taken a turn for the worse. The whole family was at his bedside when he passed away peacefully, a little after 7 o'clock on Monday, the 14th of July, 2003. The final cause of his death was heart failure. After all the stresses that his body had been through, from the operation through to his lung collapsing, his heart finally gave in. I have always been the rock in the family, so now I had to be strong. I prayed to God for him to give me the strength. All I felt like doing was collapsing with my grief, like my mother, sister, and brother were doing around me. It was difficult, but with God's help, I managed. There were so many things to take care of, so many people to notify. Zelda came through to my parents' house to pay her respects, but she didn't stay long, as I had much to attend to. I had to arrange the funeral, so I went to the funeral parlor by myself. It was easier that way. I was operating in my normal, cool, and efficient manner. I was strong for everyone, but mostly, I was strong for Dad's sake. The day went by in a blur, and by evening, everyone needed to eat, so I decided to get some takeaway pizzas. I was tired, sad, and stressed. And while I was waiting with my nephew to get the food, I called Zelda. She asked what time I would be leaving to go home. I told her I didn't know, as I was still sorting out dinner. What she said next blew my mind. She said something to the effect that I would rather have supper with my family than be with her. I totally flipped, and I told her to get lost. Here I was in this traumatic time, trying to be the strong person, organizing everything so everyone else could grieve, and she was upset that I wasn't with her because I was with my family. I knew then that, despite our recent friendship, we would never be anything more than friends. She was more concerned about herself than anyone else. With hindsight, I'm sure that she never meant... Well, I don't think she ever meant it like that. She probably meant that she wanted to be with me, for me, but she chose the wrong words and the wrong time. I went home a little later and got into the shower. It must have been around 9:30. And as I stood under the shower, my emotions finally overcame me and just poured out. I cried like a baby. I couldn't stop. I was finally able to grieve. I spoke out loud, trying to communicate with my father, telling him all the things I was sorry about, like not having spent more time with him, not having been there when he collapsed. I thanked him for all the things he had done for me. In my bathroom, I have a large mirror that has 11 lights above it, much like the makeup lights found backstage in the actors' dressing rooms. The light second from the left had not worked for a long time, and I hadn't got round to fixing it. And while I was talking to my dad, this light began to flash, almost like a fluorescent globe as it begins to light up. I kept quiet, staring at it as though it wasn't happening. I then said aloud, "Dad, if you are there with me, then make the light flash again right now." The light flashed again. I kept quiet for at least 2 minutes, and then once again I said out loud, "Dad, if you're here with me, then make the light flash again right now." The light bulb flashed again. I felt goose flesh all over my body as sobs engulfed me. I repeated everything I'd said earlier, just in case he'd arrived late and missed it. Later I spoke to Zelda and told her I didn't want to see her anymore. She wanted to attend the funeral, but I said no. I felt that I would have enough pressure and stress to deal with, without worrying about whether she was receiving sufficient attention from me. I had also been speaking to Debbie, and she was very supportive and concerned, as she always was. I also said to her that I didn't want her to attend. My focus had to be on my mother and my mother alone. I didn't want a partner or ex-partner there because I knew probably I wouldn't have been able to carry off the strong man role. When I'm hurting, I need to be alone. I need to withdraw into myself, as this was the only way I could know how to deal with things. Debbie emailed me the most fantastic and appropriate story that night, which I chose to use as part of my speech at the funeral, which was held on the following Thursday. After reading it, I immediately realized that the message in the story described how my father lived his life. I've made some minor adaptations, but the context is the same. The story is called The Philosophy of Wine. A philosophy professor stood before his class with some items in front of him. When the class began, wordlessly, he picked up a very large and empty mayonnaise jar and proceeded to fill it with rocks about 5 centimeters in diameter. He then asked the students if the jar was full. They agreed that it was. So the professor then picked up a box of pebbles and poured them into the jar. He shook the jar lightly. The pebbles, of course, rolled into the open areas between the rocks. He then asked the students again if the jar was full. They agreed it was. The professor picked up a box of sand and poured it into the jar. Of course, the sand filled up everything else. He then asked once more if the jar was full. The students responded with a unanimous yes. The professor then produced a bottle of red wine from under the table and proceeded to pour the entire contents into the jar, effectively filling the empty space between the sand. The students laughed. "Now," said the professor as the laughter subsided, "I want you to recognize that this jar represents your life. The rocks are the important things, your spiritual life, your family, your partner, your health, your children, things like that. And if everything else was lost, once they remained, your life would still be full. The pebbles are the other things that matter, like your job, your house, your car. The sand is everything else, the small stuff. Now, if you put the sand into the jar first, there's no room for the pebbles or the rocks. The same goes for your life. If you spend all your time and energy on the small stuff, you will never have room for the things that are important to you. Pay attention to the things that are critical to your happiness. Take time to grow your spiritual life and your relationship with the Lord. Play with your children. Take time to get medical checkups. Take your partner out and do the things that you both love doing. There will always be time to go to work, clean the house, give a dinner party, fix the household appliances. Take care of the rocks first, the things that really matter. Set your priorities. The rest is just sand. One of the students raised her hand and inquired about what the wine represented. The professor smiled. "I'm glad you asked. It just goes to show that no matter how full your life may seem, there's always room for a good bottle of red wine." After the funeral, the family went to the crematorium, where we said our final goodbyes to Dad. Eventually, the day was over. I had managed to get through it, posing as the strong man, but only with God's help. When I got home that evening, I received a call from Debbie to see how I was doing. She asked if there was anything she could do for me. I instinctively told her that I wanted her to be with me. I needed company. I needed someone to share my grief with me. Before I knew it, she was there. She dropped everything and made arrangements for her mother to look after the boys. On the day my father passed away, I asked my mother where he would have liked us to scatter his ashes. She said he'd always loved the mountains, and specifically the Drakensberg Mountains. So I arranged to take the entire family, my mother's sister, Linda and her husband, Pedro, their 2 teenage children, my brother Mark, Brett and Shana, to the Drakensberg for the weekend directly after the funeral. I hired a bus and driver and arranged for us to stay at the Drakensberg Sun Hotel. Mark had arranged to have some bottles of red wine labeled with a photograph of my father, which we took along with my father's ashes. I asked Debbie if she would come with me, and she did. Once again, we were back together. On the Saturday morning, we all hiked up the mountains and found an appropriate spot where we had a picnic. We opened the wine and scattered Dad's ashes. Despite the terrible red wine, it was a fitting farewell to a very special man. Lessons learned. 79, we take our lives and those of our loved ones for granted. We seldom take the time to communicate all the things that we should to our loved ones. and then we regret it if they suddenly pass away. 80. I believe that after we die, there is a period when our souls are still on this planet. It allows us time to say our last farewells before the souls depart. In August 2003, there was another significant change in my personal life. Shayna, who had just turned 16, came to live with Brett and me. In December 2002, Jenny and her husband immigrated to London, as he had been battling to find work in South Africa, in spite of being a well-skilled craftsman. Jenny has a British passport, so they decided that there would be better opportunities for them in London. The original plan was that Jenny and David would go across and settle in, while Shayna would move there the following year in July or August and complete her education in the United Kingdom. Jenny and Shayna decided that it would be better for Shayna to stay with Jenny's mother in Jenny's apartment for the next few months and continue at Sandringham High with her grade 10. They felt it would not make sense for Shayna to live with me because it would mean her changing schools. I agreed, as it would be difficult for Shayna to settle into a new school, to make new friends, and then leave in a few months later. What I did not agree with was the fact that Shayna would complete her education in the UK. Although I didn't have a close bond with Shayna, I somehow knew that she wouldn't like the UK. But mothers and teenage daughters always know better, don't they? In April 2003, I bought Shayna a ticket to London to spend a couple of weeks with Jenny. When she came back, she had made up her mind that she did not want to complete her education in the UK. She was also battling to live with her granny, but we agreed she should complete the year at Sandringham High and then come and live with me at the end of the year. Shayna was also struggling without her mother, as they had a strong relationship. The result was that her grades were really poor. She was a lost soul. Fortunately, she had a new boyfriend, Brad, who was a fantastic person. So at least she had someone that she was close to. During this period, she used to come and spend some weekends with me, but she also spent a lot of time at Brad's parents' house. By August, she couldn't handle living with her granny anymore. She'd been talking to Debbie about her frustration, so the two of them decided that Shayna should come and live with me immediately. Debbie and Shayna are both Leos, which by default means that they are both drama queens. So I was no match for them, and I had to give in. The biggest challenge was transport for Shayna to get to school and back. But between her and Debbie, they found a student to provide the service for a handsome fee. Adjusting to this change was difficult for both of us. Shayna was an extremely lazy and untidy person, which drove me crazy. She'd inherited this tray from her mother. In fact, I remember tidying Jenny's bedroom when we first started dating, when Jenny was 19. I'm a relatively neat person. Things don't have to be spotless, only neat and tidy. For months, Shayna and I bumped heads over this, and normally it would result in me emptying her messy cupboards all over the floor and making her repack them. At the time, I was not very close to her, so I think I misinterpreted a lot of her emotions. I thought she was battling without her mother, which was partially the reason, but with hindsight, I realized it was also because she was desperate to have a relationship with me. She was as unhappy living with me as she had been living with her granny. It became frustrating because she would be crying to her mother and Jenny would be phoning me to try and teach me how to deal with Shayna. I wasn't partial to this distance learning program that Jenny was trying to provide me with, so one day I told her, in not-so-polite terms, to back off. I only had two expectations of Shayna, which were simply to keep her room and bathroom reasonably neat and to make an effort to do some schoolwork, neither of which she was doing. Once she started making an effort in these directions, I would make an effort to forge a better relationship with her. My view was that if she wasn't prepared to respect my basic wishes, she could not respect me. Eventually, we both managed to get our acts together, and fortunately, we have now developed a very strong, close relationship. Lessons learned? 81. For people to live together in the same environment, that is, a family, a commune, a flatmate, or a lodger, there have to be some ground rules agreed to up front. This alleviates unnecessary stress and altercations. 82. Do not compromise your relationship with a person because they remind you of someone else. 83. Not everyone sees things the way you do. That doesn't make them wrong. It only makes them different. If their behavior and their views are that noticeably different, then make sure you have applied Lesson 81. As a male, being the single parent to a teenage daughter has other challenges. Shayna and Brad were still going strong. They'd been together for at least a year and a half when I started to become concerned about contraception for her. Shayna was 17 and a half when I decided to do something about it. Although she claimed she was still a virgin, I was worried that in a moment of passion and weakness, this could change in a flash. I had no aspirations of becoming a grandfather at 43. So I made an appointment for Shayna to see a female gynecologist. It was easier to make the appointment than to attend it. I arrived there with my young, attractive daughter and walked into a waiting room full of women, all giving me the beady eye. No doubt they were thinking that I was a lecherous old man with my young girlfriend. I've never had so much attention focused on me at any one point in time. I almost began to feel ashamed. Meeting the aged female gynecologist was not much fun either. She asked why we were there, and I explained that I wanted Shayna to start taking contraceptive pills as a precaution. She gave me an interrogation of note, claiming that I shouldn't be encouraging my daughter. I simply told her I'd rather be safe than sorry, as she was in a serious relationship. I remember wondering that were I her mother, whether I might not have been given a pat on the back for my mature approach. She then proceeded to give Shayna a physical checkup in a curtained-off cubicle. I was distinctly uncomfortable being in the same room at that time. Finally, she wrote the script for the pill. I mentally prepared myself for the attention I would receive as we walked out of the consulting room and into the waiting room, filled with disgusted females. Towards the end of 2003, Pat's house was due to be completed, and so Debbie had made plans to transfer Trevor and Callum from their current nursery, that preschool in Benoni, to a school close to their new home. Pat had sold her house, and the family had to move out by the end of November 2003. As is usually the case, the building contractors were behind schedule, and so Debbie asked if she and her boys could stay with me for 2 weeks until their new house was ready. I agreed, and they moved in. They also moved all their stuff to my house to be stored for the final move. It was one thing having the kids for a weekend, but a whole new ball game having them for a longer period. Brett, Shayna, and I found that out the hard way. I took the boys to school every morning and fetched them almost every day. Debbie now had this long commute through endless traffic to the other side of town to her new job. Being such a highly stressed person, she easily succumbed to the frustrations of sitting in slow-moving traffic, bumper to bumper, for up to an hour each way. By the time she came home, she was in a foul mood, and having to deal with bathing and feeding the kids just compounded the problem. She was used to arriving home with her domestic worker having done everything. I helped out from time to time by bathing and feeding them, but I had this growing resentment that I was not their mother. Why should I take them and fetch them from school, bath and feed them, and give them the love and attention that they sought only from me? She rarely expressed her appreciation or thanked me. I felt I was being taken for granted. Inwardly, I knew she appreciated what I did, but my issue was that she didn't express it, so I backed off and let her be a mother for a change. She became like a tightly strung bow. Something had to give, and when it did, I was normally on the receiving end. The whole environment was new to me. Selfishly, I was used to having my own space, lots of it. Perhaps not as much now, since Shayna had moved in. I felt claustrophobic. I was counting down the days until the 2 weeks were up and Debbie and her kids would move in with their mother. I have no doubt that Brett and Shana were counting as hard as me. The scheduled day to move was Friday the 12th of December 2003, and the day finally arrived and I took the kids to school with a smile on my face. Unbeknown to me, Debbie approached this very same day with concern and anxiousness. She phoned me at work that morning and asked me this curveball question that I hadn't seen coming. "Are you going to marry me?" I clearly remember sitting at my desk, trying to understand where this question had come from. Not once had we ever discussed moving in together or getting married or anything as serious as that. In my mind, two things were clear to me. Firstly, I'd told her on our first date that I didn't believe I would ever get married again. Secondly, we had what most normal people would consider to be a volatile relationship which needed to be dealt with before anything else. My response was measured. I said I hadn't considered ever getting married again, but I was committed to being in a long-term relationship with her, and we would see over a period of time where it would lead. She was insistent and asked me again, "Are you going to marry me?" I responded by saying that I couldn't promise her that either way right now. Her response was that as I couldn't give her the commitment that she needed and wanted, she would be foolish to continue wasting her time and love on me, and that she would move on and find the right partner for herself. I hadn't contemplated the end of this relationship, but for me it was a moment of truth. Yes, I did love her, but I was not ready or interested in getting married again. The institution of marriage was meaningless to me, but I could understand her view. I could have been selfish, which was not out of character for me, and tried to convince her to reconsider, but I didn't. I merely said that I loved her and did not want to have the relationship end, but equally, I could not promise her that I would marry her in the near or distant future. She said that our relationship was now over and she would move all her belongings out of my house that afternoon. She then put the phone down on me, and I was shocked and surprised. Was perhaps the best thing for us, so I accepted it to be fate. I arrived home at about 17:45 that evening, poured myself a drink, and sat down in front of the television to contemplate my new bachelor status. I had left for work that morning, excited about my return to quiet sanity, no screaming, crying kids, just peace, home, single. Be careful for what you wish for, as you might just get it, was one of the thoughts that came to mind. Now I was a little bit angry. Why could she not have brought this up before? Why did I have to go through 2 weeks of hard labor with her kids, her foul moods, and her temper? Couldn't she have said something before? Short while later, I heard a car in the driveway, so I went outside to see who it was. To my surprise, it was Debbie and her boys. She got out of the car, looked at me, adopted her all-too-familiar stubborn stance, and blurted out, "I can't do this. I can't live in two homes." But before she could get into her car, I retorted in my normal, clever-at-the-time way by saying, "Well, then don't," and turned and walked back into the house. Obviously, I was still pissed off, but I felt that I deserved the right to be. Surely the measure of a balanced relationship is that you can both be pissed off at the same time. She clearly didn't share my philosophical viewpoint, so she got in the car and drove off. She phoned me a few minutes later and told me that our relationship was over, but I knew that already from the morning's telephone conversation, but perhaps I am slow at times. And so at the age of 42 and a half, my fourth significant relationship ended after 13 months. Rather make that a year and 1 month, as it sounds better, doesn't it? Lessons learned. 84. Lack of communication creates huge expectations and or misunderstandings. Never assume you know what your partner wants and or expects. Always ask them to tell you and vice versa. Once you have asked them, and they have told you, don't assume that is it. Over time, people and their environments change as do their needs and expectations. you have to continuously revisit your mutual needs and expectations, communicating these either verbally or alternatively, it is easier by writing notes or letters to each other. 85. Be careful what you wish for, as you may just get it. God listens to us all the time and sometimes decides to give us what we ask for just to teach us a little lesson. 86. Two wrongs don't make a right. As difficult as it is, even though you may have won the battle, you may need to broker the peace in order not to lose the war. Two stubborn mules pulling in opposite directions will not move the cart forward.